All right, time to dive into a really interesting case, Smuck versus Hobson.
Ah, Smuck versus Hobson.
Yeah, from 1969, Washington, D.C. It's about school desegregation.
Okay.
But it gets into some fascinating stuff about legal power struggles and maneuvering, even foreshadowing some future battles.
You know, what's fascinating is this is after Brown v. Board, right?
Right.
Separate but equals out the window. But before we get those later cases that really nail down, how do you make schools equal?
Yeah.
So Smuck is in this weird in-between space, trying to make the Constitution happen, but also not, like, step on the toes of people actually running things.
Yeah, because you've got these black families, low-income families in D.C. basically saying, hey, the way this school system is set up is hurting our kids.
Yeah.
And they're challenging very specific things, like how attendance zones work.
Yeah. So these optional zones, right?
Right.
Sounds fair on paper.
Yeah. Choose your school.
Choose where your kid goes. But what it meant was white families could just avoid the black schools.
Right.
Even if they were closer.
Right.
So you had this like built-in segregation, even if it wasn't explicitly said that way, the impact was undeniable, though.
Totally. And it wasn't just attendance zones, right? They also went after how teachers were assigned.
Absolutely. Faculty assignments were like concentrated by race, basically.
Oh, wow.
So some schools always got the newbies, others got the experienced teachers.
Right. Just perpetuating the divide.
Yeah. Totally deepening that inequality. And then you've got the track system, the famous grouping kids by ability.
Yeah.
Now, critics at the time were saying this is just baked-in discrimination.
Right. Like, you're locking kids into paths based on these tests that are probably biased anyway.
Yeah, you're assuming these assessments are some neutral measure.
Right.
But they're not. So, Smuck goes after all this.
So, big picture, how did the court actually rule on all of this?
Well, the judge sided with the families, actually, on some key points.
Okay.
Found that those optional zones and the biased teacher assignments unconstitutional.
Oh, wow.
Seems like a win, right?
Yeah, it sounds like a victory.
But that's where the story takes a turn, because the school board itself was split on what to do next.
Okay.
They vote not to appeal.
Really?
Yeah. But the superintendent, Carl Hansen, he wants to keep fighting. And then you've got a board member, Carl Smuck, dissenting. He feels the same way. And on top of all this...
Oh, wow. This is getting complicated.
You've got parents who are also like, hold on, we don't like this ruling either.
Okay, so lots of different people wanting to weigh in here.
Yeah.
But legally speaking, can they just do that?
That's what makes this case so cool legally. The court had to figure out who even has the right to appeal, to intervene. Like, who has standing?
Oh, right, right. It's like that legal VIP pass. You can't just barge into any courtroom and start arguing. You got to show you're really affected by this.
Exactly, exactly. So, did they have that pass?
Good question.
Good question.
So, let's start with the superintendent, Hansen.
Okay, so Hansen, he ends up resigning in the middle of all this.
Oh, wow.
And the court's basically like, well, you're not the superintendent anymore. No authority to appeal.
Case closed for him.
Yeah, pretty straightforward lesson on standing there.
All right, so what about Smuck, the board member? He was dissenting, wanted to take it further, right?
He wanted to go solo on the appeal, but the court said, nope, you were outvoted by the full board.
Right.
Individual board members can't just go rogue because they disagree.
Right. The board as a whole has to speak for the system.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So that's two down.
Two down.
What about those parents, though? They were unhappy with the ruling, too. Did they have standing?
The court said absolutely.
Interesting.
And this is huge. Their kids' education is directly at stake.
Right.
So this reinforces that parents have a fundamental interest in their kids' schooling. You can't just brush them aside when big decisions are being made.
Absolutely. Makes sense. So we've got the parents in the mix. They're allowed to fight on.
Yep.
But where does this leave us with the actual policies they were challenging? Like, the court sided with them on attendance zones and teacher assignments. But what about that track system? Did Smuck v. Hobson get rid of that, too?
That's where it gets tricky.
Okay.
So striking down the zones, the biased teacher assignments, that all stood.
Right.
But the track system, they left it mostly untouched.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
If separating kids by ability is so obviously problematic, why not just end it right there?
It's a good question. Here's the logic, right?
Yeah.
The court basically said, sure, tracking might have bad effects.
Right.
But in this case, they didn't have enough proof to show that it was intentional discrimination.
Oh, okay.
It's like they needed that smoking gun, not just a hunch that things were messed up.
So even if it's clear some kids are getting a worse education, it's not enough. You have to prove the school board meant to do that.
Pretty much. And this is where courts always have this balancing act.
Yeah.
Righting wrongs, but also respecting the folks who were elected.
Right, right.
The judges in Smuck, they were walking a tightrope.
Totally. Okay, so mixed bag ruling, some things struck down, some not.
Yeah.
But I bet the judges themselves had some strong opinions on all this.
Oh, absolutely. This case is actually famous for its concurring and dissenting opinions.
Right.
Like, judges agreeing, but for different reasons, or flat out disagreeing.
Yeah.
Really gives you insight into their whole philosophy.
Lay it on us then. Who was riled up and why?
Judge Danaher, he wrote this fiery dissent, worried about judges having too much power. Like, unelected judges shouldn't be telling schools how to run, even if their heart's in the right place.
Right.
He felt these were political choices. Leave it to the school board.
Yeah, classic argument. Let the people decide, not the courts. Still hear that today.
All the time. Now, Judge Berger, he went on to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, remember?
Right, right.
He had a different take. He thought the court's ruling was more like advice to the new school board, not a you must do this kind of thing.
Nice. That's a pretty weak response to families who feel their kids are being actively harmed.
Yeah, it does show you that more hands-off approach.
Yeah.
And it hints at Berger's later skepticism of, like, a big federal power getting into local schools.
Oh, interesting, interesting. Okay, so we've got one judge worried about overreach, another pushing for local control.
Yeah.
But what about the judges who formed the majority? Why'd they strike down some things but not others? What was their thinking?
Their focus was laser-like on clear constitutional violations. You know, those zones, the biased teachers, that was blatant discrimination, needed a firm hand.
Right.
But they also made it clear, we're not trying to micromanage every little thing the school does.
Right. So stopping specific bad actions, but not dictating every detail.
Exactly. It's all about that balance. And that's the thread through this whole case, right? Striking some stuff down, leaving other stuff alone, acknowledging the school board has some power.
Yeah.
But pushing back when needed. It really shows you how messy desegregation was back then.
Absolutely. Sounds like Smuck v. Hobson is more than just a case.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a snapshot of America in 69.
Totally.
Dealing with civil rights, education. What role courts should even have in all of this?
It's remarkable how many of those issues are still with us today.
Give us some examples. Like, what are the modern day connections to this case?
I mean, think about school choice debates, charter schools, how we use standardized tests for admissions.
Right.
All these tap into those Smuck questions. Who decides about education and how do we make sure every kid has a real shot?
So these old legal battles are still playing out in today's classrooms. That's fascinating.
They really are.
Okay, so lots to unpack here. But I'm still stuck on the track system. If those parents felt it was discriminatory, why not push back harder when the court basically left it in place?
That's where standing comes back in. Remember, to sue, you got to show you're the one being harmed.
Right.
The parents could fight the zones, the teachers, because that was directly hitting their kids.
Okay, so that's clear cut. But tracking was different.
Yeah. The court didn't say, okay, here's the new system, no more tracking.
Right.
They just said the old way was bad.
Right.
So the school board still had control over how to group students.
Ah, I see.
The parents couldn't point to some specific harm from that part of the ruling.
That seems kind of unfair, though. If they saw tracking as part of the problem, why not challenge it head on?
It shows you the limits of law, even when you've got a strong moral argument.
Right.
And it highlights how important it is to have the evidence to back up your claims.
So in a way, the fight against tracking was just beginning with Smuck. This case kind of laid the groundwork for later challenges.
Exactly. And it reminds us that social change, it often happens in stages. You build on each win.
All right. So we've covered the rulings, the judges' opinions, the whole historical context. But I got to be honest, the track system really stands out here. They tackle the obvious stuff.
Yeah.
But leave this more subtle, but arguably just as damaging, practice alone. Why do you think that is?
It's a great question. And I think it gets to the heart of what Smuck can teach us.
Yeah.
On one hand, the court's willing to step in, say, these policies are discriminatory, get rid of them.
Right.
But when it comes to tracking, which is more about how teachers teach, how they see student learning,
yeah,
they get hesitant.
So it's like they're comfortable saying, this is clearly racist,
yeah,
but less comfortable saying, this way of teaching is flat out wrong.
Exactly. And there's probably a few reasons for that. First, like we said, the court wasn't totally sold that the track system was designed to discriminate. even if that's what ended up happening.
I get that legally, but it's still frustrating, right? Shouldn't the impact on the kids be enough?
It's a valid point, and it's one that would gain more traction as, like, legal thinking involved.
Yeah.
But in 69, not quite there yet.
So the law itself was almost lagging behind what was actually happening in schools.
You could say that, but there's another factor. This idea of judicial deference.
Okay, break that down for us. Fancy legal term. What does that mean?
Basically, courts don't like to second guess the experts.
Right.
And when it comes to schools, they see educators as the experts, especially on what to teach, how to teach. So they're reluctant to step on toes there.
So it's like they're saying, hey, we're not education gurus. We're not going to tell teachers how to run their classrooms.
That's a good way to put it. Fine with stepping in on clear discrimination, like those zones, but on teaching methods, more hands-off.
But wouldn't you argue that teaching methods, like tracking, are often full of bias, even if it's not on purpose?
Mm-hmm.
How can they just ignore that?
It's a fair critique, and one that, you know, gained momentum in the years after SMUC. But at the time, the court seemed to be making this distinction between deliberate discrimination and unintended consequences, even if those consequences were, like, predictable and harmful.
So if a policy wasn't designed to hurt minority students, it was okay, even if that's what happened. Seems like a low bar for a system that's supposed to be getting more equal.
Definitely raises questions, right? And it shows laws can only do so much.
Right.
They can ban outright discrimination, but it's harder to get rid of those subtle biases that keep inequality going.
Right. Okay, so we're saying even if the track system wasn't totally wiped out in this case, Smuck v. Hobson still kind of forced people to look at these subtle biases in schools.
Yeah, definitely. And it's not just about the actual court ruling, you know. SMUC kind of had this ripple effect, more attention on tracking, how it affects kids. It fueled this whole movement, even if it took a while to really see the changes.
Right, like planting a seed, maybe. SMUC wasn't the final win, but it created the space for change to happen later.
Exactly. It reminds us that social progress, it's rarely the straight line, right? It's messy, it's step by step, it takes a bunch of people pushing for it over time.
Makes sense. So what happened with tracking? Did things actually change or did it just stay in place?
Well, SMUC wasn't the end of it. Like, the debate kept going, and then in 1971, so just a couple years later, we get Hobson v. Hansen, which actually did strike down the track system in D.C.
Wait, hold on. Hobson v. Hansen? Wasn't Hansen the superintendent who was trying to appeal in SMUC?
He was. And get this, the judge who decided Hobson v. Hansen was the same one who did SMUC a couple years earlier.
Wow, that's a twist. So the judge who basically left tracking alone the first time around ends up changing his mind. What happened?
Well, a few things changed the whole situation, I think. First, there was just more evidence coming out about how much tracking was hurting kids.
Okay.
Especially Black and low-income students. And at the same time, how the law thought about discrimination was changing too. Courts started recognizing that even without proving intent, you know, like they meant to do this, if a policy clearly had a discriminatory impact, that could be unconstitutional too.
I'm guessing the whole civil rights movement played a role in this too, right? Putting pressure on institutions to get rid of racist policies, even if they weren't meant to be racist. You know what I mean?
Totally. The fight for equal education was gaining steam, and courts were definitely starting to reflect that.
Okay, so tracking gets struck down in D.C., but I'm guessing the debate didn't just go away, did it?
Nope, you're right. The whole argument about ability grouping and how it affects students, that's still going strong today.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Some people say, look, if you group kids by ability and it's done right, it can actually help them learn at their own pace, all that.
Makes sense.
But others are like, nope, any kind of ability grouping, it just makes existing inequalities worse. It puts limits on kids, boxes them in.
Wow. So this case from 1969, we're still dealing with those same questions.
Absolutely. And that's what's so wild about Smuck v. Hobson. It's not just some old legal thing. It shows us this ongoing fight for educational justice in America.
All right. So as we're wrapping up our look at Smuck, big takeaways. What should we and our listeners really be thinking about as we see these issues play out today?
Well, a few key lessons here for sure. First, parents speaking up. That matters.
Mm-hmm.
The parents who got involved in Smuck, they were crucial. Pushing back, making sure their kids' voices were heard.
It's like a reminder, right? Parents have a right, maybe even a responsibility, to hold schools accountable and say, we need equal opportunities for every student.
Totally. Second, SMUC shows us how important it is to get how the law works, how you can use it to make change. Stuff like standing, intervention, all those legal terms might seem technical, boring.
Yeah, a bit dry.
But they have huge real-world impact, like who gets to fight these battles, how courts weigh in on these complex questions.
It's a reminder that law isn't just this, like, theoretical thing.
Right.
It's a tool you can use to fight injustice. But you gotta know how to use it right.
Exactly. And lastly, I think SMUC teaches us progress takes time. It takes people who don't give up. It's rare that one court case just flips everything over.
Right.
It's more like you get these legal challenges, policy changes, and then slowly people start thinking differently about stuff.
It's a marathon, not a sprint, like they say.
Exactly. And you gotta have people willing to run that marathon even when it's tough.
Well said. Yeah, it's not like flipping a switch. Things don't change overnight.
Nope. And it takes those people who are willing to, like, stay in the fight for the long haul.
So even though tracking stayed in place, at least for the moment in SMUC, it does feel like a turning point, right? It forced people to start really looking at those subtle biases in education, even if the law wasn't totally caught up yet.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. It wasn't just the legal outcome itself. It was like SMUC started this conversation that wouldn't go away.
Right, like a ripple effect going out from there.
Exactly, yeah. It helped build that movement to dismantle tracking, even if it took time to, like, fully play out.
Right. It's like, okay, SMUC planted the seed. Might not have been the final victory right then and there, but it created the conditions where change could happen later.
I like that analogy, yeah. It reminds us that social progress is rarely, like, neat and tidy.
Right. Never a straight line.
Messy. Takes a lot of different people pushing for it, and over time, things can shift.
So what happened with tracking, ultimately? Did things change, or did it just stay in place?
Well, like I said, SMUC wasn't the end of the story. The arguments about tracking kept going, and in 1971, just a couple of years later, you get Hobson v. Hansen, which actually did get rid of the track system in D.C.
Hold on, Hobson v. Hansen. Wasn't Hansen that superintendent who tried to appeal in SMUC?
That's him. And get this, the judge in Hobson v. Hansen, the same judge who decided SMUC.
Wow, talk about coming full circle. So the judge who basically left tracking alone a few years before ends up changing his mind. What happened there?
I think a few things shifted the landscape. Like, more evidence was coming out about how tracking was really harming students, especially Black and low-income kids.
Okay, yeah, makes sense.
And legal thinking on discrimination was evolving, too. Courts started to understand that even without proving, like, the school meant to discriminate.
Right, right.
If a policy had this clear discriminatory impact, that could be unconstitutional too.
I'm guessing the whole civil rights movement played a role too, right? All that energy and activism, putting pressure on schools, on courts, to get rid of policies that were hurting minority students, whether it was intentional or not.
Oh, absolutely. The push for equal education was getting stronger, and courts were reflecting that.
So tracking finally gets struck down in D.C., but I'm betting the arguments didn't just disappear.
Nope, you're right. The whole question of ability grouping and what it does to students, that's still a hot topic even today.
Wow, really?
Oh, yeah. You'll have people saying, look, grouping kids by ability, if you do it right, it can really help them learn at their own pace and all that.
Right, right.
But then others will say, no way. Any kind of ability grouping just ends up making those existing inequalities worse. It limits what kids can do, puts them in a box.
It's wild that we're still having these same debates. Sparked by a case from 1969.
Right, and that's what makes SMUC v. Hobson so fascinating. It's not just some old legal thing. It's a window into this ongoing struggle for educational justice that's still happening.
All right, so as we wrap up our deep dive on SMUC v. Hobson, what are the big takeaways? What should we and our listeners be thinking about when we see these issues playing out today?
Well, I think there are a few key lessons here. First off, parents getting involved, speaking up, that's huge. The parents who stepped in SMUC, they were a big part of pushing back against those discriminatory policies, making sure their kids' voices were heard.
It's a good reminder that parents have a right, maybe even a responsibility, to hold their schools accountable and say, hey, we need equal opportunities for all students.
Couldn't agree more. Second, SMUC shows us that understanding how the law works, how you can use it to create change, that's powerful. All that stuff about standing, intervention, those legal terms.
Yeah, the jargon can be a bit much.
It can seem pretty dry, but those things have a huge impact on who gets to fight these battles, how courts make decisions on really complex issues.
It's like law isn't just some abstract concept. It's a tool you can use to actually fight injustice.
Yeah.
But you got to know how to use it the right way.
Exactly. And last but not least, I think SMUC teaches us that progress takes time. It takes a lot of effort, a lot of people staying committed. It's rare that one single court case just changes everything overnight.
Right, it's more like a series of legal challenges, policy reforms, and people's mindset slowly shifting.
You got it. It's a marathon, not a sprint, and you got to have people who are willing to keep running that marathon, even when it gets tough.
Well said. And on that note, thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Smuck versus Hobson. Really interesting look at a case that's both historically important and still relevant to the conversations we're having today.
My pleasure. And to everyone listening, keep questioning, keep learning, and keep fighting for what's right.